All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got Mr. Joe Sinnott on the line with us. He's with the Energy Detox Podcast, as well as the CEO of Whiting Partners. How's Joe doing today?
Joe is doing fine. Mid-March, enjoying life. Had a bit of sunshine this past weekend, so feeling pretty good, Jason.
Well, if it sounds like I'm tiptoeing a bit to start the interview off, it's because I am. I'm just trying to pull up the bracket as we talk a little bit about March Madness. A lot of stuff going on this year. One of the big controversial years because you had some out-of-nowhere teams winning their conference tournaments, therefore creating 5-6 bubble teams out of nowhere, which I find very funny. You know, people trying to manage speculation and trying to justify speculation when really the whole idea is to, you know, play the games on the court. And so, you know, that's kind of changed a little bit in today's world. But let's talk about March Madness in relation to the business world. I'm not talking about the $5 billion wasted on time and energy watching the games, filling out the brackets and all that fun stuff that goes along with it. You've seen those polls, Joe, haven't you? The amount of wasted resources because of March Madness.
Yes, it is a significant sum of time and again money, but hey, this is an institution. We don't talk about that when we have a day off for July 4th, so you could argue that.
One of the things I thought we could do is to integrate in some of the challenges that our March Madness coaches face. And, you know, whether it's the hot streak or whether that's the one and done, whether, you know, it might be one of the, you know, we'll give an example for each one. And the first example I give is, of course, happening throughout sports. It's happening throughout corporate America. I'm going to give Nick Saban as my example. I know he's football, but there's also basketball teams, and Ed O'Bannon was the famous basketball player that sued the NCAA to make sure he gets compensated for his name, image, and likeness because, you know, UCLA was making money with video games, having him, you know, be the person. So, you know, without getting into that, I just call it a side hustle. You know, whether you're making money on the side as an athlete because Mercedes is paying you to drive around, you know, or Brian Bosworth getting paid by an oil company to get a suntan and make sure he watches those oil rigs move up and down. That's my favorite sponsorship of all time. But in corporate world, Joe, there is a lot of side hustle going on. There's a lot of people who are utilizing company time and company resources in order to benefit themselves personally on the side. That's a tough one nowadays because so many people look at it as, well, the horse is out of the barn, too bad. But at the same time, people are like, hey, if I'm paying you for 40 hours a week, can't you give me at least 30? My goodness, you're on social media 20 hours a day trying to, you know, sell your pyramid scheme products that you have going on or whatever the side hustle might be. But anyways, Joe, talk to me about balancing that fine line, because whether it's March Madness or it's corporate America, it's happening. People are blending that remote office into, you know, there was a famous line in Fast Times at Ridgemont High when Jeff Spicoli ordered a pizza. If it's my time and your time, why can't we have pizza together? So, you know, that wasn't the line, but he was trying to justify the sharing of time. So if you're in corporate America, how do you weed your way through that, if I may ask, or if you're in the NCAA or whatever?
Yeah, well, we could start with corporate America, because hearing you talk, Jason, made me think of, I think it was maybe a year or so into COVID when, you know, you start getting these stories and trends. And I remember one of them, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, was talking about people that were literally holding two jobs. So not just side hustles, but, you know, remote workers who, you know, were on, you know, would basically have two jobs. You know, they recognized that they, you know, could get their basic job done in whatever, you know, 15, 20 hours a week. And so it was funny, you know, they were profiling some people anonymously who, Yeah, you know, occasionally they'd have a conflict and overlapping Zoom calls, and they'd have to figure out a creative way to do that and not get caught. But anyway, you know, my mind goes to that, which again is new, right? I mean, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't a thing, you know, to the extent it is now. It wasn't really an option before COVID. Yes, people have always had side hustles. People have always perhaps found ways to make an extra buck on their primary company's dime, but you know, there's lots of different options now, which brings us to the sports world, right? You know, you mentioned Nick Saban at the beginning, and you know, that was all of his, or a lot of his recent comments about how things have changed. And this isn't what he signed up for. Things are different. And, you know, just because they're different doesn't mean they're worse. But, you know, to your point, Jason, what he recognized is that some of the side hustles, if you will, or some of the lack of focus, I should say, you know, some of the kids, the college kids that he was coaching, their focus clearly was not primarily on the betterment of themselves and their team. And that's what Nick Saban signed up for. That's what he did. He, you know, again, you can go back and read his quotes directly. I don't want to misrepresent them, but my interpretation listening to him was, hey, look, Nick Saban enjoyed molding these young men into, you know, their future selves. But now they're so darn focused on the side hustles and the short term and what's in it for me that, you know, he felt essentially incapable of fulfilling that bigger mission. And again, he claims that that's why he left. So again, bringing that back to corporate America, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean you shouldn't have side hustles? Absolutely not. Nick Saban, again, he's a fan of the whole name, image, likeness thing. He thinks that's a good thing. He said that. But it's when you get to the point where you can't focus on your primary responsibilities that something's got to shift. Something's got to change. And so if you're a leader in corporate America, and, you know, I think by and large for, you know, many of the companies and the individuals I work with, the idea of a side hustle is somewhat foreign, just because, you know, typically they're working two jobs, but they're working two jobs for the same company. But in all seriousness, if you're a leader and you're managing these things, it all comes back to what Nick Saban, you know, did for all the various decades of his career, you know, in college sports, not in his NFL world, but that is focus on the long term. What is the end state? For a college student, the end state is being a productive member of society, building the foundation that you can continue growing on. And so in the corporate world, if you don't have that relationship with your employees, if you can't speak about what their ultimate goals are and how you can help them get there, well, it shouldn't come as a surprise if they, you know, if those employees wind up shifting their focus, looking for other ways to better themselves, even if they're short-sighted. And once you get to that point, you know, it's tough to shift gears, quite frankly, Jason. And, you know, that's why Nick Saban, again, the big piece of why he hung up his coaching hat, if you will. And we can talk about that, you know, probably shift into basketball mode, which we talked about at the beginning. But, you know, that's what I see. And that's some of the impetus behind some of this shift in focus, if you will, is, you know, in many cases, leaders who haven't been able to or don't really have a desire to play that long game with their employees.
Well, it's interesting how the shift in culture has bled into so much more of our daily lives, to where that's actually the reason Nick Saban cited for leaving. The culture has changed so much. It's no longer about honing the skills of these young men. It's now about how they can advance their professional career. So when you take a look at Caitlin Clark, I believe is her name, from Iowa, the mm-hmm. female basketball player. So have you been following that story about the women's basketball player who just beat Pistol Pete Maravich for the scoring record, and she's gotten a lot of fame. Mm-hmm. Oh, and what's interesting to me, out of all the debates going on about what's going on with her and her career and et cetera, one of the main topics of conversation is whether she should go to the pros or not, because she's going to take a pay cut. She's making more in college because of NIL sponsorships than she'll ever make in the WNBA. And what's interesting about all these conversations that people are having about Caitlin Clark, who's rejuvenized female basketball on all levels, from the pro down to probably, you know, 5-year-old girls picking up a basketball, wanting to emulate her, that no one is talking about what kind of education she's going to get. So what Nick Saban was talking about is one of the reasons Bobby Knight got fired. He cared too damn much about the kids, right? He cared so much, he choked them to death, right? He just choked them, threw chairs at the referee because he was standing up for his kids. But Bobby Knight's excuse was always he was actually looking out for the kids' betterment as a moralistic human being. And every person has their different approaches. Nobody's talking about that anymore in sports. It's how they can springboard and leverage their employer. In this case, the NCAA is really what's happening, is a lot of these people are using the NCAA in order to amplify their skills, which is no different than what corporations are trying to do and that sort of thing. So that's how I kind of look at it, where, you know, when you take a look at a workplace, Joe, one of the questions I think any board of directors, any CEO, any chief culture officer, any chief sustainability officer, any sort of executive C-suite officer, number one question now that they should probably ask, what is our current culture? What is it we're trying to do? Because Nick Saban and other coaches, and this is one of the reasons I think Bobby Knight had a hard time too. I mean, get into the controversial side or the professional, you know, eloquent side of Nick Saban, was the culture change. It just completely changed. Mark Eaton, God rest his soul, he was on the Crude Life program talking about how John Wooden would have got fired. Dale Brown said the same thing, former coach of Shaq and LSU. Dale Brown, John Wooden of UCLA, the most successful coach in college basketball history, would have got fired because it took like 10 years for him to build the triangle offense that went on to win like 13, 15, 17 championships in a row, whatever they had when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was there and Bill Walton and all the other studs. So what do you make of that, Joe, that, you know, taking a step back, taking a look at the, you know, NIL example and Nick Saban and Caitlin Clark and some of these others, maybe that is the first question somebody needs to ask in today's day and age, because so much has changed. Like, what's our culture? What is it we're trying to accomplish now?
Yeah, well, I'll take it a step further, because culture, again, we could talk about culture, but, you know, sometimes people's eyes, they glaze over, right, Jason? It's just one of the culture. What is culture? But you asked a question in the last minute or two, and you said, what are we trying to do? You know, that's a very specific question, right? It implies some sort of action. What are we trying to do? And if the answer is, hey, we're trying to get these, you know, 18 to 22 year olds, or I guess now in college sports, there's what, 25, 26, 27 year olds, and, you know, have been around there almost a decade. But regardless of the age, you know, there's a question of, well, we're trying to get these young men and women to maximize their value, right? To generate, you know, the highest returns possible and boost their brand. And again, we ignore what we just talked about at the outset, which is, well, what's the long-term prospects? And so bringing it back to those different coaches who cared, right? You know, another example from pro sports would be Buddy Ryan, right? Of the Bears. You know, he from the outside would not be somebody that you would say, oh, I want to go work for this guy, right? I mean, this guy is, you know, he's a crazed man. But then you hear the players and they say, man, Buddy loved you, right? Like he might not say it, but you knew that he cared for you.
By the way, But Buddy Ryan, Bobby Knight, original cancel culture, right?
Yeah, 100%. But
so bringing somebody on the sidelines, I love Buddy Ryan.
Well, that's it. Yeah, and him, and, you know, him and Mike Ditka again. They, you know, they got into some fisticuffs too. But the problem is, Jason, now, and again, call it cancel culture, call it whatever you want, call it, you know, soundbite culture or TikTok culture for as long as you can until it's banned in the United States at least. But whatever it is, if you're just looking at some formula to say, hey, you know, what's going to generate the biggest short-term returns, are you really going to subject yourself to an individual like Buddy Ryan or Bobby Knight, who are clearly playing the long-term life game for these individuals. And I think in a vacuum, you know, again, you sit down with a 18, 19-year-old, you explain this to them. I think it's innate that they would get it. The problem is there's so much noise, Jason. There's so many distractions that to have a conversation about culture and long-term results, you're competing with all of that other noise, all of those other people chattering in their ears. And again, bringing it back to the corporate world, it's no different. You know, how many employees, again, are looking over the fence and they're looking at competitors and they're looking at all these opportunities. And, you know, people are constantly bombarding them with, well, you're better than this. You know, hey, you could shift over here. Can you fault an individual for, again, feeling like, hey, you know what? The grass might actually be greener. I would say no, especially if they're not getting that internal support from their management, from their leadership, that's able to paint that long-term picture, Jason. So again, whether it's a, you know, 30-year career individual in the corporate world, or again, you know, somebody that's just entering or is in college, it's no different. There's so many distractions. And the only way to cut through those distractions is key one-on-one, concentrated, focused leadership. And again, I would probably add coaching.
So let's talk about the one and done. Rick Pitino, John Calipari, that's one of the things that they struggle with is the one and done nature of, you know, the freshmen. They come basically and use Kentucky or wherever Rick Pitino is at nowadays. I don't even know anymore. Is he at Temple or where is he at now?
He's actually at St. John's. So it's funny, you're saying one and done. You know, I assume you're talking about obviously the players who show up for 1 year and then yes, skedaddle. But Pitino and his St. John's team this year, they're zero and done because they didn't make the tournament actually. So he's on the disgruntled list right now because
no kidding. Okay.
So anyway, sorry, just to clarify, if anybody's listening there that knows their story, that yeah, they're and I think they're done. I think they actually declined an invitation to the NIT. But anyway, sorry, back to your
done. They pulled the Penny Hardaway. We're not going no matter what.
Well, yeah, and they're not alone. There's a couple other teams. But again, that's a story for another day or another minute if we go there today.
Yeah, well, the one and done, what we're talking about is exactly that. These players go to a program that is specifically designed to springboard players into the NBA draft. And so what was set up to be something good turned out to be pretty much abused, really, and to where the coaches, it turned out to be a problem for them, and they didn't know how to change that, right? Because you're not going to turn down these great players, but at the same time, your culture was for 3 years at least to hone these players, not, you know, this quick one and done type of a thing. Compare that to the corporate world. I've seen you mentioned TikTok earlier. I've seen social media videos where people are justifying job hopping, where they're talking about that, you know, the employee that sticks with the company for 10 years makes 40% less than the person who has 8 jobs in 10 years. And when you start hearing that, boy, that's an easy justification for job hopping. Whereas before, loyalty was basically the main thing. Dependability, loyalty. And so on one hand, you know, if you're an independent small business, there's some opportunity because you can guarantee to a company you're going to stick around for a year. We'll sign in a contract and everything. Whereas an employee, how much do you want to invest into somebody who is now being told by people, hey, if you go to 8 different companies in 10 years, you're going to make 40% more than if you stay with that one company. So one and done is happening in college sports, whether it's Memphis or Iona or St. John's or where's Kentucky. You know, those are some programs that I guess Calipari and Rick Pitino were a part of. But again, like I said, Joe, this is now happening on social media to where they're, you know, podcasters and training people are basically trying to do economics. Life economics for people, life coaching economics for people on how to, you know, do the one and done in corporate America. How do you advise C-suite America on how to handle this problem? Because it is a legitimate problem, Joe.
It is, well, I guess the first piece of advice is to avoid calling it a problem. So that's my first piece of advice for, you know, leaders in the C-suite is stick to the facts, you know, because as soon as you start talking about it being a problem or good or bad or short-sighted, as true as those things might be, once you start injecting some sort of subjectivity or talking about the ideal or whatever, it's very easy for your audience to dismiss you as having some unrealistic view of the world. What you're better off doing, Jason, is sticking to the facts. So stick to the facts of, hey, you know, here's the financial impacts of job hopping. If it's whatever you said, you know, hey, you're 40% more in the short term by bouncing around jobs instead of staying put. Stick with the facts. Don't run away with them. And in fact, if you feel like you have a strong argument for people to stay at your company long term, embrace those facts. Say, yes, in the short term, absolutely, you're better off going somewhere else. But we've also done the math on what it means to stay here long term. We've done the math on what our investments that might be somewhat intangible, how those intangible investments lead to tangible long term results for our employees. So to me, Jason, that's it. You use math first to your advantage, and you don't be scared of this, and you don't try to talk about loyalty and all these other words that, again, you know, aren't going to mean a whole heck of a lot, unfortunately, to a lot of people. So I'll pause there, Jason, but that's the first sort of red flag that I hear is when people start talking about subjective terms and, again, culture and, oh, this, you want to be here because X, Y, and Z. No, if your audience is interested in math, then start with math.
Really, that's the way to look at it, because if the culture, you know, is, or the idea is to make money, is to better your family, well, maybe to better your family goes beyond money. Maybe this person, you know, allowing you flexibility to go and, you know, grab your kids because they get off at 4 o'clock. So all of a sudden, you know, they're being flexible with your time and those sort of things. That's what I always look at when it comes to a lot of these different, you know, whether it's one and done or you're with somebody for 10, 20 years, that type of a thing. There's so much focus on the math of money to where, how do you put a value on some of those intangibles? You know, the fringe benefits, if you will, because I do think when somebody is figuring out the math, they do need to put a value on the intangible. And that intangible value might be different from you or for me. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's funny, Jason, especially if I'm working with people who are in career transition, that's exactly the exercise to say, hey, look, what is it worth for you to keep your kids in the same school or the same school district and not have to, you know, move a couple states? Just put a number to it. You know, well, what would you pay for that stability? And for some, it might be zero. You know, they might say, hey, actually, I'd pay to get him out of our current school. That's fine. So that's, I mean, I don't think I need to expound anymore, Jason. Those are the type of things I ask people to do, is to quantify the unquantifiable. Talk about, hey, how much would you pay to live in a warmer climate? Or how much would you pay to, again, have that extra 2 weeks of vacation? Because to your point, Jason, it's going to be different for everybody. But you gotta, that's why you gotta move away from some of this arm waving, you know, words and get back to the math.
You know, I'll give you a funny example that happened over just the NFL free agency in the last week. Of course, a lot of different moving around. And for some reason, I want to say it came from Atlanta. I don't know this for fact, but because of the Kirk Cousins news and everything else along those lines, a lot of, you know, weirdness came out. But one of the reasons somebody chose a specific location was had to do a daycare. And basically what it boiled down to was the organization offered, you know, daycare as one of their amenities, but then they turn around and charge the players for a daycare. So they kind of, anyway, so I thought, well, there's an intangible. That's trust. They don't trust their organization, so they left. So that's a huge deal. I just interviewed somebody from RMI Supply, Todd Workman. He's the president CEO, and I bet he said the word trust 147 times during the interview. where I just flat out said, we've been talking a lot about some of the intangible marketplace advantages right now. And boy, it sure seems like trust is a word that's out there. And, you know, whether it's a university or whether it's corporate America, you know, when you talk about the one and done, a lot of those kids are putting their livelihoods into John Calipari or a Rick Pitino because they trust that that program is there because of the past experience and everything. So before we get into Duquesne, talk to me a little bit about trust, how you view trust right now out there in the marketplace, whether it's, you know, March Madness, kids going through the basketball programs, or, you know, people staying with their current company or trying to go into a new workplace and then start that trust from square one again.
Yeah, well, to hear you say square one, Jason, is what I see, that people are impatient and very often it takes time to build trust. So the challenge is for a lot of people that I work with, how do you accelerate that trust building? How do you get people to the point where, again, your team trusts you in a relatively short amount of time? Because you know the cliche, right? You know, it takes a lifetime to build trust and, you know, what, a couple seconds to, you know, to destroy that trust. And it's so true. But again, now, you know, we've mentioned it multiple times already, in a world where you're competing with everybody else for attention, how do you accelerate that trust? How do you get people to that point where, hey, they can look you in the eyes and say, you know, this is the person that I want to play for or work with or whatever the case is. And again, it's going to be different in different environments, but you got to start by asking that question. Hey, what are all the ways to not just build trust, but accelerate that trust to get to the point where, okay, now you can start actually taking some actions, doing things with these other individuals. So now they can, you know, they can see that trust actually in the real world and it's not just words. So again, there's a million different ways to do it. It's going to be, you know, specific to the circumstance, to the company, to the team, of course, but that's it, Jason. That, you know, I spent a lot of time with people saying, all right, you know, you might not have 6 months, 12 months, 3 years to build that trust. So let's take the time to get things in motion sooner rather than later.
We mentioned Duquesne a second ago, you know, or NC State, whichever, you know, is kind of the Cinderella story, the viral moment that your company has, that big sale, the quick success. Talk to me about how to deal with that. I look at it this way, where, you know, momentum is hard to get, and sometimes you get it quick, and now you got to manage and maintain it. And managing and maintaining momentum is so much harder than getting momentum. But talk to me about that, you know, that viral moment your company got, the big sale, you know, your euphoria. What's going on now? You're, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, well, a couple pitfalls when you get to that moment of euphoria, whether it's in the sports world or the business world. And again, Duquesne obviously relevant here, coming to you from Pittsburgh. So that's the big story in the sports world here, that Duquesne is headed to the tournament for the first time since 1977. So again, all over the headlines, clearly a feel-good story, but one that, again, like you said, now they got to perform, right? They got to beat BYU here in a couple of days. So what are the traps? Well, the first trap, Jason, is not celebrating the wins, right? You know, not allowing it to sink in, not giving those players at least a couple moments to rest on their laurels, to enjoy the moment. It's so tempting. And again, you know, coming to you from somebody who's focused on the oil and gas industry, it's so tempting to say, all right, great. What have you done for me lately? Right. What's next? You know, how are we going to build on that last win, that this moment of euphoria? And again, that's what allowed the energy industry to, again, grow to what it's become and to make the impact that it's had. But sometimes, Jason, you got to look for those moments to just stop and celebrate the wins. So that's the first pitfall. And I'd say, you know, the other pitfall is, you know, forgetting to build on your strengths, forgetting to build on the things that were put in place all season, not just, again, an upset victory or a last minute shot or whatever. it's very easy to get caught up and almost find yourself making excuses against yourself to say, hey, man, you know, we don't really belong here. You might not verbalize it, but again, it's a big threat to start saying, hey, this moment of euphoria, we're not used to this. This is the first time in 47 years. And you're going to have a lot of people who, you know, while at the same time they're celebrating you on social media and they're saying, yeah, go Duquesne, they're also jealous. They're also looking for reasons to knock you down. And if you give them that opportunity to make you think that, you know what, maybe we really don't belong here, so let's just have some fun and see what happens. Again, you're setting yourself up for success. Now, addressing both of those sides of the equation, again, the threat of feeling like you don't belong, and then again, pushing a little bit too hard, too fast after a moment of euphoria. Again, it all comes back to effective coaching, understanding the moments, understanding how to leverage every single moment, positive or negative, so that your team can move forward. So I'd say I'll pause there, Jason. There's all kinds of threats that come with success, especially, you know, sort of instant success, if you will. But those are probably two of the biggest ones that I see that translate very nicely into successful teams in the corporate world.
You mentioned you're coming out of Pittsburgh. Pitt, big disappointment. They had a good resume. They got left out of the tournament. You mentioned Anthony Hardaway at Memphis before the selection committee even started. They said they're not going to the NIT, so it's either NCAA or nothing. And so, or March Madness or nothing. So when I take a look at, you know, Pitt, for example, or some of the other teams that might have been left out on the bubble, that's disappointment. And there's legitimate arguments. I mean, you've got teams that, you know, had maybe a lesser record on paper, less sales, less quality sales. Well, they had this advantage over our advantage, the strength of schedule, that you can start analytics and splicing and dicing like crazy. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with legitimate disappointment, because in your mind, you know, you brought game. You got a legitimate argument. How do you deal with that? If you're a company, you didn't get the big sale because so-and-so is related to so-and-so. So there you go. Tough. You guys built the better mousetrap, but hey, John Kerry's sweet nephew got it. Whatever the deal is. But disappointment when, you know, you've got a great resume, you've got a great mousetrap you built, but you didn't get picked. You didn't get it. How do you deal with that? Because that happens quite a bit.
It does. And again, I don't know how much worse or more significant it is this season than other seasons. But again, being here in Pittsburgh, as you mentioned, Pitt was one of those teams that said, yeah, we are upset. We don't think this is fair or correct. And yeah, we're not even going to the NIT. We're done. That being said, yeah, how do you deal with it? Whether it's sports, whether it's the corporate world, the first thing that I do when I'm working with leaders who are in this position where they have a team or specific team members who have legitimate reason to be disappointed, the first thing to do is lay out all of the things that can't be taken away. Lay out all of the things that, again, are there no matter what. Whatever successes, whatever victories are there, whatever, again, milestones, that's where you start. That's where you start. That doesn't mean you don't acknowledge, hey, you know, disappointment. That's fine. But you absolutely need to be ready to shift gears to all of the things that they've already built. And again, Jason, this is probably as cliche as it gets, right? This is probably, you know, motivational guru talk 101, but it's so easy to forget when you have teams that are performing at a very high level, both in sports and in the corporate world. And when you have individuals who are performing at a very high level, both in sports and the corporate world. And when you have coaches or leaders or CEOs who are used to success, they're used to being, you know, top of the pedestal, if you will, which of course means that, again, as cliche as it is, there's a much bigger threat that they could be knocked off that pedestal, which is why it's important for them to surround themselves with all of the existing victories, all of the existing progress that that team has made. And if you do it in a way, Jason, that doesn't sound like just, you know, making a silver lining, if you will, because it can, right? It can come across as completely inauthentic. But the key to avoid that is to be ready, is to not do it in the moment and say, hey, guys, you know, what I like about the fact that we're not going to any tournament this year is, it gives us more time to get a head start on the golf season. But unfortunately, for leaders who aren't prepared for that moment to deal with disappointment, it's amazing how often they'll utter something, I don't want to say stupid, but certainly counterproductive like that. So it all comes back to preparation. It all comes back to, I guess, my world of coaching from a leadership coaching standpoint, executive coaching standpoint, saying, hey, what are all the different things that could happen here? For Pitt, for example, it's pretty binary, right? They were either going to make the tournament or they weren't. So for their coach, Jeff Capel there, and reading some stuff here, seems like he was certainly ready. They knew they were on the bubble, but that's it, Jason. It's being prepared with what you're going to say so that in the moment you don't do something that's going to violate trust, that's going to demoralize your team, that's going to make you look like an ineffective leader, if not, a sour idiot. So that's my key to success in those not so enviable situations, Jason.
Taking a look at some of the other happenings throughout March Madness, there are examples of like a mentor and successor or teacher and pupil and that sort of thing. Every single year, there's generally a storyline like that. And so when I take a look at what's going on right now in Pittsburgh, where you're at, my mind goes right to Justin Fields and Russell Westbrook, because here you have a very interesting situation, which is very applicable to corporate America, because, on one hand, you've got somebody coming in who's technically supposed to be a mentor and hand the baton off to somebody. But in his mind, he's thinking, hey, I'm an old dog that can still hunt. I'm going to prove to you guys. And here you got somebody coming in who's kind of got a little bit of defined role. You're going to be the backup, but we're going to also put you into that starting role as soon as we can, as soon as you're ready. Okay. We brought in the mentor to help hone your skills, and he's going to take the realms, that sort of thing. This happens all the time. You got CEOs and you've got presidents and that sort of thing, where maybe it's an outside hire, maybe it's an inside hire, but they'll announce it ahead of time many times. And so how do you deal with that, the transitional leadership? Because whether it's a merger, whether it's cleaning house, whether it's bringing in new people, there's a lot of that happening right now, where people are trying to figure out, how do we really meld this together and have a seamless transition? Because you're bringing in two styles. And the third style, which is like the board of directors, is the one that's supposed to happen. And so you're trying to get that to jive a little bit. And that happens in March Madness. But I was just thinking the Justin Fields, Russell Westbrook example might be just a little bit more sexy, if you will.
Well, sexy or not, again, it's another Pittsburgh tie. So yes, from Friday afternoon, through the weekend, where we already knew that Russell Wilson was coming. Then it was announced that Kenny Pickett was heading to the Eagles, and speculation of whether the Steelers would get Justin Fields, which they ultimately did. The one thing that was apparent to me listening to, sports radio and talking with, fellow Pittsburghers here, especially the true Pittsburghers. Again, I'm not a native, but for those who have, rabid Steeler fandom flowing through their veins, what's apparent to me, Jason, is it's the narrative, right? And how, atrociously controlled or non-controlled the narrative is in these situations. And obviously, just like in a corporation, there's always limits on, what you can say and not say, and there's timing and there's leaks and everything else. But the number one issue with all of these situations, especially when it comes to touchy things like, transitions and succession planning, it's controlling the narrative, Jason, because we're not just talking about the two individuals, right? We're not just talking about Justin Fields and Russell Wilson. And we weren't just talking about Kenny Pickett and Russell Wilson. We're talking about the entire team, right? If not the entire fan base. And so it's amazing how companies, and obviously the Steelers organization as a company, but whether it's an energy company or a pro football organization or whatever, it's amazing how they fail to control the narrative. It's amazing how they fail to identify who their audience is, what story their audience is going to come up with, and how that story might be detrimental to their ultimate goals. So that's where we start, Jason. In terms of the actual transition piece, you know what? That could be easy. That could be really easy if you have a consistent story. And again, going back to the word that you brought up there a while ago, earlier in this conversation, trust. If you're communicating in a way where your fan base, if you will, your employee base, your team, if they have trust in you and the process and the handover, if you will, you're going to be in much better shape. But again, companies, teams, they fail to get ahead of these narratives. They are very good often at making up lots of excuses why they can't say something about it. But, you know, sometimes that just requires a little creativity. So sorry if I got on my soapbox there, Jason, but it's amazing how often leaders fail to think about their audience and play a little bit of, all right, well, what are they likely to make of this?
One of the offshoots and indirect consequences narratives can bring, and a lot of different things in life, is labels. And, you know, one of the narratives of March Madness is, you know, there's always a 12 that defeats a 5, and there's always a Cinderella story, and, you know, the bubbles and all these different things. Sometimes that can happen in corporate America, is that, oh, that person is just that, so they can get a label or they can get pigeonholed, because as you're trying to direct the ship, those people who are entrusted with directing the ship, they can do that. They can label people and they can pigeonhole people and that sort of thing. How do you overcome that? How do you identify that? How do you avoid that? Because labeling and labeling sometimes can be good. That's why we have label makers, right? So we can do that, but it can also be bad. That's why we have discrimination laws. So that's why we have these different things. A lot of times, you know, labeling is not meant to happen in a malice type of a way, mm-hmm. but it can very quickly become that to someone who doesn't want to be in the mailroom their whole life. They just wanted an opportunity because they watched the Michael J. Fox movie Secret to My Success, and you start in the mailroom, and pretty soon you're CEO. Well, sometimes if you start in the mailroom, you do such a good job, you're labeled as the mailroom warrior, and they don't want to have you get out of there. So talk to me about the labeling and how to overcome that, because that is one of the things that, you know, people have issue and fight and combat and adapt, and it impacts workplace.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I spend a lot of time on that as a coach. And in fact, it's probably one of the most enjoyable things I do, which is going out within an organization and identifying those narratives, especially narratives about a specific individual leader that I'm working with. And, you know, I and most other coaches would call them 360 degree conversations, and not just sending forms out for people to complete, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, how is this person at X? And maybe there's a couple open-ended comments, but I'm going out there and actually having conversations, confidential one-on-one conversations with various stakeholders. And that is the best way to, one, identify what those narratives are. It doesn't matter if they're true or not, of course, but actually identify some common themes, some common narratives. So then I can go back again, you know, all under the umbrella of confidentiality, but I can paint a clear, consistent picture, bring it back to that individual, and then start first and foremost with, well, is this true? And sometimes the narrative is, and sometimes it isn't. But what happens, Jason, is as these narratives evolve, you know, a lot of times the individual, they don't even know what's happening, right? They have no idea how strong a given narrative might be. They might know that it's out there, or there's whispers or rumors or whatever, but they have no idea that that's the first thing that comes to mind when some independent coach comes in and starts having a conversation with their stakeholders. So, Jason, you can't do anything until you actually understand what those narratives are. But if you're just speculating, if you are an individual, Jason, and you think you know what people are saying about you, it's amazing how off base you might be, how wrong you might be. So before you invest all kinds of time, energy, money, trying to shift that narrative and control the narrative, take a step back and make sure that you're actually working with legitimate, factual data. And again, it sounds like you might be on mute there, Jason, or you want me to just keep going with this topic, but
no, I either was way, on that's, mute that's there. The key there. I was on mute and I had my thumbs were a little bit oily and I couldn't push the button on one of those screens. So, oh, well, technology got me back.
Well, that's funny because I've heard stories about you. There is a narrative going out there that you are Mr. Oily Thumbs. That's that is a pervasive story that I've heard in my conversations with others. So maybe we need to address that, Jason.
Good old Jason Oily Thumbs. You bet. I love that. That's a great nickname. What do they call him? Oily Thumbs. Well, he's always got the oily thumbs, you know. actually, I was putting some coconut oil on my skin, basically trying to moisturize here as I'm down in Arizona where we've got a little bit of dry heat happening, which is nice. But so Arizona, they were supposed to be a one seed. They ended up, I think, as a two seed in the West Conference. And so, you know, you take a look at the different paths and you take a look at what the experts say and you take a look at, you know, the different areas where some people are in North Carolina is fixated out in the West and that sort of thing. How is it that an organization can get across what the mission is here? Because when you take a look at, you know, Arizona's path or North Carolina's path, whatever it is, realistically, what do you have? You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 games. And so do you just focus on game 7? Is it one game at a time, you know, one sale at a time, one project at a time? Because you do have an annual, probably even a 5-year projection type of a thing. So, you know, whether it's the 5-game projection to the national championship, but we got to do each quarter at a time or each game at a time. Joe, how do you advise somebody? Because coaching in March Madness is really just like a CEO trying to navigate a 5-year plan.
Yeah, well, the most effective CEOs, though, recognize when it's just survive in advance versus, hey, let's be thoughtful and put in place all of the, you know, strategies, if you will, and investments that are going to lead us to success 5 years from now. So, Jason, in the NCAA tournament, or perhaps I think, you know, even a better analogy is these conference tournaments, right? Where it's, you know, 3, 4, sometimes 5 games in a row. You just need to survive in advance. And that's okay. So the effective coach recognizes that, you know, this isn't some game in January where you're not going to, you know, you're not going to risk, you know, burning out your players. And sometimes, you know, I don't want to bring another sport here, but, you know, baseball's an even probably better analogy, right? 162 game season. And, you know, how do you manage your pitchers and everything else? But an effective coach, an effective leader recognizes those times where it's just go, go, go. And it really is one game at a time. And you can't even think about the next thing, the next day, the next game, because there might not be one. And again, where leaders in corporate world miss opportunities, if you will, if not violate trust, Jason, is when they switch back and forth between that, again, survive in advance, one day at a time versus, hey, we're playing the long game. When they switch back and forth without explanation, without giving any color in terms of, hey, this might seem like a short-sighted decision, but this is how it's connected to our long-term plan, our long-term vision. So again, it largely comes back to what we've talked about multiple times already today and in prior conversations. And it's about controlling the narrative. It's about proactively addressing what you know your audience is going to think and say about a decision that is seemingly inconsistent with the decision you may have made a week prior. So, you know, if you can't recognize that, you know, there's the occasional one shining moment, and then, you know, sometimes you need to focus on 5 full years of shining moments, then you're going to find yourself in a very, very tricky spot where your team doesn't trust you. And where, again, you're probably not going to be hanging around long enough to actually see your long-term plan come to fruition.
Have you got any predictions for the tournament this year? Are you doing any brackets or anything?
I haven't filled out a bracket yet. I definitely will be in a couple of pools, but as of now, you know, I'm a sucker for an upset and the underdog, but I'm, you know, if I were putting money on this here, I'd be going with the up with the repeat there for UConn, Jason. I think were they the top overall seed? Whether or not they were the top overall seed, I don't know that they're going to be shaken from that perch. So that's where I'm at.
This has been one of the years I've probably followed college basketball the least. And when I did a quick skim, UConn was the one that jumped out to me as well as kind of the team that would probably win. I have no idea what their record is. I think they did get the number one seed overall. But UConn just, take a look at their history, take a look at everything else, and they seem to just have, on paper, the complete team to do this. I'd love to see Duquesne. That'd be fantastic. I saw Grand Canyon snuck in. You know, they got like four losses this year. I'll be rooting for them. They're a 12 seed going against a 5 seed. Although I think the 6-11 has been kind of the upset special the last 10 years. You know, the 12-5 for years, it was like you could bank on one of those 5 seeds dropping to a Ball State or a Grand Canyon or a Florida International Owl Sanctuary. I think they made it too, 8 or 9 seed this year. But anyway, any upset specials that you want to put out there?
No upset specials. I mean, I think it's tough not to look at St. Peter's and, you know, not recall their miraculous run there a couple of years ago. So St. Peter's, I think they were a 15 seed a couple of years ago. They're playing number 2 Tennessee. So, you know, can they repeat that magic? Obviously with a very different team than they had there a couple of years ago. But no real predictions, Jason. I'm kind of like you. This was probably the year that I paid the least attention, thanks in part to my alma mater, Notre Dame, not having much of a season to write home about. They didn't have to worry about declining any NIT invitations. I'll say that much. But no, as always, just rooting for some upsets. And, you know, if I do well in any of these pools I enter, then so be it.
And in closing, Joe Sinnott, of course, with Winning Partners, as well as the host of the Energy Detox Podcast. What's the update on the Energy Detox Podcast as we close the interview here?
Well, it's still clicking along. Reached 4 years of existence here. It launched in mid-March 2020, you know, right there as the pesky pandemic kicked off. So, yeah, 91 episodes in, Jason. The last one we did was a live episode there to honor World Shale Energy Day and St. Patrick's Day, which also happened to be Selection Sunday. So had a live episode there to honor that occasion or those multiple occasions. And yeah, still clicking along, Jason. Still, you know, weaving together energy industry themes, leadership themes, current events, sports to, you know, to provide something that's a little bit different, right? You know, there's enough generic leadership stuff out there, Jason. There's no shortage of books and gurus and blogs and podcasts and webinars and seminars and everything else. But, you know, my aim with the Energy Detox is to be a little bit different, to cut through some of the, not just nauseating, but sometimes toxic leadership mumbo jumbo that's out there and have a little bit of fun. And, you know, while it may pale in comparison to the fun that we have here on the Crude Life, Jason, still clicking along here as I enter year number 5 of the Energy Detox.
This is Joe Sinnott with Winning Partners and the Energy Detox Podcast.